You're listening to a Rock Candy podcast.
You have arrived at your destination.
Oh man, Joe, it feels like it's been a minute since we've done this. I gotta be honest.
Has it? Well,
maybe not. Maybe we just planned to record this one a couple times and had to push it, and that's why I feel that way.
Probably. Yeah. It's been at least a week.
Okay. All right. Well, so nothing crazy then.
Maybe.
I know what
it was. What is today? Tuesday? It was the Sunday before last, right?
Yes. So I know what it was. It was because we did a two-parter.
Is it Wednesday?
It is currently Wednesday, yes, as we record this.
Good grief. I thought it was still Monday.
Nah, man, that was 2 days ago. Don't worry, all days are the same and time no longer exists. But we did record two parts at once of Kevin Smith. So that's why it feels like it's been a while, because we just been releasing Kevin Smith stuff.
Yeah,
so.
your dad bringing out his Photoshop skills, man.
Oh, man, he was killing it, right? I saw that. I was like, that's disgusting. I don't care about that at all. I don't care for that. But it looked, people need to see this, even though it's not.
My oldest memory of your dad is him showing off his Photoshop skills.
Oh, for real?
Yeah. The first time I went to your dad's house when we were kids, he had the picture on his wall with his stepson.
Yeah.
Like doing multiple things in a room.
He would do clones. He would do photographs with like multiple of the same person doing different things in the photo.
Yeah. Just at the time, just so impressive. How do you do it?
Dude,
you
know, he's OG Photoshop. He's been doing that forever. Yeah. So if you don't know what we're talking about, go follow our Instagram, because my dad put together a thing of Joe and I as Jay and Silent Bob for our Kevin Smith episodes.
Yeah. I was feeling good about his choice to, I don't know if he meant to, but like making me Silent Bob was unexpected, but I enjoyed it.
I sort of was thinking about it.
You think
it
was just my strong beard?
See, I wondered if it was a combination of things. So first of all, yes, the strong beard helps, because that's sort of a Silent Bob trademark. But then also I noticed in that shot that he used, Jay is wearing a Buddy Christ shirt. And so I was like, oh, okay. So it's like got the religion... you know, the religion instructor thing, and then also the
fact connecting
that,
the dots.
Exactly. Yeah. It all works together. It all comes together. So I was thinking about doing something, and I'll cut this out if you don't like it, but I figured it'd be better to just see what happens rather than talk to you about it beforehand, because it wouldn't be organic. I was thinking about letting people know two topics that are coming up in case they either want to engage with the stuff. Or like, you know what I'm saying?
This sounds like a bad idea.
Does it? See, I'm curious. I'm curious if this will work. I want to try it and make it a thing.
Yeah, give it a go. But I think at least your dad will hear it and suggest something.
Okay, something. So the thing is, I'm not throwing this out there because I want people to, hey, give us feedback on what you want us to talk about. I thought about that. Like, we're going to do this movie. Let us know what you want us to talk about. I don't know that I want to do that, but I do want, like, I don't want people to see the episodes coming up and go, oh, I haven't thought about that in a long time, or I haven't seen that movie or whatever it is, or I don't know who that is, and just skip by it. So, like, I want to let them know what's coming up so that, hey, there's a good chance you have more hours because people are losing work. So watch one of these movies or something.
It's not one of these, like, if you haven't seen this, hit pause, watch an entire movie, and then continue listening.
Exactly.
No one's going to do that.
That's my thought. So
they're going to hit stop, and then they're going to listen to something else.
Exactly. That's what I would do, of course.
Oh, I've done that so many times.
Yeah. So here's the two that I'm gonna throw out there. One is not really to prep. I just want to hype people up. So we are going to have an episode, maybe a two-parter, not sure, coming up where we talk about 90s and early 2000s punk rock and pop punk.
Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that. That's one we've already tracked. It was a great conversation.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, oh, are we recording another? Oh, no, we've recorded that already.
Yeah, we did that. So I can already say
I'm unprepared.
Yeah, I can already say it was a good one because we already did it.
was
and
a good one.
And another one that we have coming up that we haven't recorded yet, but we know we're going to do, and these are both going to kind of be special episodes, which is going to be fun. At some point in the future, probably the mid-future, is going to be, we're going to do an episode on...
right in the middle of
right
the future.
Right in the middle. Like, think about how long the future is and then split it in half. We'll be in there.
Could be short.
It could. Who knows?
It's not looking good.
No, it's not a great prospect. But we'll get this episode in there before the world ends, which is we're going to talk about House of the Devil, which is a fantastic movie.
Oh boy. And if you haven't seen House of the Devil yet.
Dude.
What are you doing?
What are you doing? You're going to want to listen to this episode, and it's going to make you want to listen to the episode even more after you watch the movie, because the movie's so damn good. It's just so good.
Let's just put it this way. It has freeze frames in the title sequence.
Oh my
That's
God.
Enough.
Yes. Yes.
And old school horror movie called House of the Devil with freeze frames in the title sequence.
Yes.
Okay.
I watched it earlier today, and I'm still just just steeping in all those good images. So good.
Yeah, steeping it.
Steeping in it. It's weird. So I tried that out. Maybe I'll do that again in the future. We'll see. Or maybe you'll do it. Who knows?
What am I doing?
Bringing up stuff we're talking about in the future.
Yeah. So let's not dig ourselves into a hole here.
Right.
You know?
Meaning what? Let's not say that we're going to ever do that again? Is that what you mean?
If we do, that's great.
Right.
But if we don't, like...
Good.
Okay.
Good. I love that this time it's me trying to like sort of derail our normal format, and you're like, let's hold on.
let's keep people's expectations
super low. Yeah. So speaking of super low, what are we talking about today?
We're talking about a little movie, little Academy Award winning movie called Parasite.
Parasite.
So I haven't seen it yet, but I've heard it's good. I'm just kidding.
Good, good. I know you're not a notes guy, but I feel like you've probably seen the film.
Yeah.
So
it's a whopper.
Here's the first question I have, which is about us and not about the movie. Is have we done an episode that's only about one movie yet? Am I just forgetting? I don't know that we've done something that's just about one film. I don't think we have. I don't know. I don't really feel like checking right now, but in my bones it doesn't feel like that's the case.
Right. So. Yeah, like,
can you think of anything? We've talked about a lot of movies, but it's usually that we're talking about the filmmaker who made the films.
And I feel like we've done at least one. Lighthouse. Did we do Lighthouse? No, that's Eggers.
No, that's Eggers. Yeah. We did Ari Aster. We did Jordan Peele. We talked about a lot of movies and filmmakers.
We did one that felt like The Witch, but it was about witches in general.
Yes, it was about witches, the concept. Yep. So, we talked about The Witch a lot because we talked about it in our witches episode and then also our Robert Eggers episode. So,
but Parasite, so hot right now.
So we're breaking some ground here. We're doing just a film. We're not talking about Bong Joon-ho all the way, you know, his whole filmography or anything. We're just talking about this movie. So,
but there are some good ones.
Oh, there's some good ones. We might have to do one in the future. But Parasite won, correct me if I'm wrong, but it won Best Picture, right?
It won Best Picture, yeah.
It won Best
Picture. I think it was the first international movie to win Best Picture.
And the first non-English movie, right?
Yeah.
To win Best Picture, which is pretty wild. So, presumably lots of people who are, some of the people who are hearing this have probably seen Parasite. I would imagine it's not like, oh, you know what? We did American Astronaut. Yeah. That's the movie we did.
American Astronaut. Yep. You're the back of your head just churning like a little hamster wheel back there.
I gradually got there because I was going to be like, some people have seen this. It's not like American Astronaut, which we talked about.
We did.
Yeah.
Good episode. Have you not heard it?
No, I haven't listened to it. No.
Mm-mm. Oh.
Nope. I don't listen to this podcast. Anyway, so Parasite is a South Korean film. It was made and released in, I don't know if it was made in 2009, but it was released in 2009. And 19. Oh, Jesus. Off to a great start.
I'm
looking in my notes at 2019, and I got it wrong still.
Yeah.
Directed by Bong Joon-ho, who's a fantastic director.
Goes by Bong Jo.
Really?
At times,
Bong Jo. Okay.
Which
interesting.
Is pretty dope.
That is dope. That's very cool.
Yeah.
I meant to look up his acceptance speech for Best Picture. Yeah, and I didn't get around to it, but I've heard that it's interesting and it's cool.
Yeah, not just did this guy win Best Picture, he won Best Director.
Yeah.
They won Best International Film.
Yeah.
And he won more that's incorrect. He tied Walt Disney for taking home the most Oscars in a ceremony.
Oh my goodness.
Academy Awards ceremony.
Walt Disney?
It's crazy. Walt Disney.
That's wild. For Disney animated features and stuff, or do you know?
I don't know what Walt Disney
would have won for.
I don't know. Yeah. Probably something 1 year, but it was like a single year. He did a lot of stuff, you know?
Yeah. My understanding, and I don't know too much about the Academy Awards and how they're structured and how the politics of that work, but my understanding from listening to sort of commentary about Parasite and its cultural impact is that typically Best International Feature is sort of to allow the Academy to only pick American movies for Best Picture. Is that your takeaway as well?
I guess, yeah.
So it's kind of wild that this one won both, right?
It is.
Yeah. So Parasite premiered in 2019 at the Cannes Film Festival.
It took home the gold.
Yeah, Palme d'Or. Is that how you say that?
I don't know.
Yeah. Anyway, it's the first South Korean film to win that. Yeah. So where do you want to dive in on this? I mean, we spoke before. There's so much to unpack. I mean, do we need to give any sort of plot summary, or do we want to just dive in as if people have seen it? What do you think?
Both. I think a good place to start is the top of the movie.
Okay.
I think what's interesting about the way he chooses to start the movie, it's this shot of like the street, right? Through a window. Mm-hmm. And then the camera, I guess it jibs down to reveal one of the main characters.
Yeah.
The son of the Kim family. And he's playing throughout this whole movie, he plays with this idea of elevation. So this family starts right in the middle. So like their house is a half basement.
Yeah.
So their feet are underground and they're peering out over ground. They're not completely below yet.
Yeah.
So it's this idea of like kind of a purgatory, but at the same time, a hopeful purgatory.
Interesting.
Like, that's interesting. So it's very hopeful that like you're always looking out into the light.
So I already have a question. Did you read the symbology being that way before finishing the movie, or is it sort of only looking back? Because when I started watching the film, I was aware that Bong Joon-ho had called this like his staircase movie, so I knew like vertical shots were, you know, meant something or something. The first time I watched it, I thought of them as being underground at the beginning. Does that make sense? Because you do have windows, but they're in a sort of half basement apartment, and so I thought of them like, oh, they're mostly, I mean, they're underground is how I thought of it.
Yeah.
But I see why you say that they're in the middle in a sort of purgatory. Yeah. And that's very interesting.
Yeah. So I don't think, okay, we're just going to have to dive right into the middle of this movie.
Let's
There's
jump
just no
in.
Way.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Okay. So this family is in this half basement, lights coming in, you know, this kid's best friend comes and kind of gives them this little mountain looking.
Yeah, it's like a rock that's supposed to be decorative, right? But is also supposed to bring sort of good luck or something. What do they call it? A scholar stone, something like that.
Yeah,
yeah.
It looks like a little miniature mountain or something.
Mm-hmm.
So already you have this starting point, and then the inciting incident is okay. Let's climb. Let's go up. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the reason I think there's significance of them being half in and half out is that there reaches a point where we actually do go in underground at a certain point in the movie.
Yeah.
So the basement of the Park's house is the basement.
Yeah.
So this family, like, it's really interesting to see like two families in a similar position, but still viewing each other as different classes, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I think that's the moment where you see what the bottom is.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
So you don't start there. You start in the middle, right?
Yes. But I think you don't realize it's the middle, right? I mean,
yeah,
that's why that moment when you learn about the basement or the bomb shelter or whatever becomes such a turn. So No one is following this who hasn't seen it. So just to give any of those people who might still be listening some sort of context, you follow one family who essentially the movie starts out and it seems like it's going to be about the struggles of this one family to sort of con this wealthy family into giving them employment, right? So it begins with the son sort of forging documents to become a tutor for the daughter of this wealthy family, and then he lies about who his sister is to get his sister employment with the family, mm-hmm. and so on and so on. And before long, this whole the four members of this family are all working for this other family under false pretenses,
yeah,
pretending to be people that they are not. And so it seems like that is what the film is going to be about. And to some extent, that would be enough, or it could be, depending on what you did with the story and the characters. But then probably, where would you say, mid-second act or something like that?
Yeah.
It takes a hard turn where you realize that there is another family who is implicated, and a member of that family, it's a husband and a wife, the husband is living in the wealthy family's basement or bomb shelter, whatever it is.
Yeah. So, and the wife is the prior housekeeper,
yes,
who the Kim family gets fired. So essentially the son kind of gets in. So that I think what's interesting, the genre bent, I keep hearing genre bending movie.
Yeah.
The movie kind of starts off as like a heist movie or something,
yeah,
right? Mm-hmm. It's like infiltrate the base.
Yeah.
So,
it's scheming, it's sort of, you know,
they do a lot of stuff that like ruins people's lives, especially this woman, right? Because this housekeeper has worked there for years, her husband had nowhere else to go.
Sure.
So she put him in the basement and she feeds him on a regular basis, mm-hmm. For 4 years.
Yeah.
And then the Kim family comes in and gets her fired by lying and making it look like she's sick and contagious. But in reality, they just keep giving her like peach hair that she's deathly allergic to.
Yeah. And they spin it as her having tuberculosis, essentially. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And they do it by, blowing sort of peach fuzz on her, and she starts to, cough or something like this. And then they plant fake blood to where it looks like she's coughing up blood, et cetera, et cetera. And so, I mean, it does start off as sort of a heist movie where they're trying to do this, and you don't learn about the initial housekeeper's husband until later in the film. This is when it sort of takes a turn. And it
like a horror thriller thing.
And I mean, so part of the difficulty of doing this particular episode is we're not really going to be able to say anything about this film that hasn't already been said, because it's had so much commentary.
There's
been so much discussion about it. And so we'll probably hit some familiar points, but at the same time, I think it's worth doing because it'll help us work through our own understandings of the film.
Yeah. I mean, that's what this podcast is, right?
Yeah, exactly. For sure.
Couple of buddies talking about the things they like.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. In a critical way. So this movie was, just a hit with another little factoid, I did come across, this film is considered part of a sort of category of South Korean films, which is referred to as, there are a few names for it, but one of the names of this subcategory of films is Hell Korea, which is a sort of satirical term that apparently has grown in the 20-teens and is used to sort of talk about movies and art that criticize the sort of socioeconomic situation in South Korea. Did you come across this at all?
I didn't.
There are other examples of it, and I didn't, you know, take the time to make a list of other films that do this. But apparently, this sort of socioeconomic conditions and income inequality and so forth are such that especially younger people are very critical of the social structures of South Korea right now. Yeah. And so this film, Parasite, is one of the sort of paradigm cases of this thing, this subcategory called Hell Korea, which is kind of about that, right? It's about, it's like films that point this out and mock it in various ways.
Sure.
And so, I don't know. So it's
and this movie also does play as a very dark comedy. Like I laughed out loud a lot, several times.
Yeah, I completely agree. So this is one of the things that you see said a lot, but is just absolutely true, is that it's difficult to talk about what the genre of this film is or what type of movie it is. It's not, whenever I saw it, initially sort of marketed, I thought it was a horror film. I mean, it's called Parasite.
Same.
But it's not. It's absolutely anything but. It has some horror film type moments, and it has some things that are uncomfortable to watch, but it's absolutely not a horror film. Did you sort of settle on what, where would you put this, right? If we were in a 1990s blockbuster, where would this go? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think maybe like, I guess thriller would be the most correct place, because it's more of a vague term of... Yeah. Some thrilling things happen in a drama.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. 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 But you're absolutely right that it is black comedy as well. It's comedy. It has horrific moments. It has uncomfortable moments. It has violent moments. It has, I saw one piece of commentary that I didn't read, but where it talked about, it described one of the scenes as an Ocean's 11 type scene or Ocean's 8,
totally.
Whatever it is.
Those montages.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that goes to what you were saying about it being sort of a heist film at various points, mm-hmm. stuff like that. Yeah. So, what were your general, I mean, I'm going to presume that you liked the film. We haven't talked about this off mic, but what were your just sort of initial responses to it?
Oh, that's a good question. My thoughts are also like kind of like specific and pointed. I don't know that I have any general thoughts other than, wow, this is kind of like just in craft, like a masterpiece of cinematography.
Yeah.
Telling the story as what
was there anything that you noticed in terms of cinematography that would make you say that, you know what I mean? Was there a moment, were there two moments, whatever?
I mean, the first moment of the film like kind of starts it like the camera literally sinks down until until he starts to go to the Park's house, like this wealthy house, and then from there on everything is upward, like the camera moves upward, he walks up the hills, things get brighter, quieter, and then even once he gets in the house, the mother leads him up the stairs, they go further up. He gets the job, he's an English tutor for her daughter. Then they start to descend, so the camera's coming back down, they follow him all the way back down. And then when they when he gets the idea to, you know, basically trick this lady into, because he's like, oh wow, she's paying me a lot of money, like their son is this kind of like disorderly little kind of crazy kid basically just he they think he's a genius, they think he's an artistic genius, but really he just needs a good nanny to kind of like
keep him
occupied, but
sure,
he has this idea to basically trick them to say, oh well, my sister is an art therapist, right?
Well, so he like, doesn't kind of, say that it's his sister, right?
Right,
he tells them that it's someone else, but
he knows.
Yeah.
And at that moment when he makes this decision, the camera sinks underneath him.
Sure.
And then he turns to her and says, I actually know. So like, I know this, and this happens kind of over and over throughout this movie.
Yeah.
So this idea of elevated status or sinking beneath, and it's like a masterclass in how to use just a camera angle to tell a story.
Yeah. And we may talk about this in a future episode, but if we do a Bong Joon-ho episode, but it brings to mind the fact that he had referred to this as his staircase movie, whereas Snowpiercer was his hallway movie. And he's very into this, at least in some of his work. He's
that
very
makes so
into
much
this,
sense.
Yeah, using space as metaphor. Mm-hmm. And so you do have up and down is just a clear metaphor. And so I think to some extent he is able to instill surprise when you learn about that first housekeeper's husband, because you realize, oh no, we weren't at the bottom yet. There's actually another subclass. And also one of the things that he's talking about and that is so brilliantly built into even the cinematography as you were talking about, obviously what he's talking about is social class, right? It's socioeconomic class. Because the Kim family is poor,
or poorer anyway. They have a hard time like paying their phone bill, keeping work, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
And the
parks are at the beginning of the movie, they're halfway in their basement and they're looking for Wi-Fi and they're reaching up.
Yeah.
Like they're reaching up toward the ceiling to get it. You know what I mean?
And they have to get up next to the toilet, right?
Yeah. Well, they're underneath the toilet.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're underneath the toilet, reaching above it to try and get Wi-Fi. To steal someone else's Wi-Fi.
Yeah, definitely. Well, and one point that's interesting, just a little tidbit, as long as we're talking about that moment where they're trying to get Wi-Fi, right? The mother says something in that scene about like, I can't get WhatsApp, you know, the app, the texting app or whatever. They apparently changed that because there's some other equivalent app that's actually used in South Korea, but they changed it to WhatsApp for an English-speaking audience, which I think is really interesting as well.
Yeah, that is.
And they did that with like some of the sort of ramen, the sort of instant noodles that show up later in the story. They changed the name of that so that English audiences would be able to understand more quickly what exactly is going on. And it's the same thing when the son gets the forged documents to get the initial job. They say something like he went to Oxford or something like that. Or he's planning to go to Oxford, but they chose that as opposed to, you know,
university. You know, you have a filmmaker who has seen a fair amount of success in the American film market.
Yes.
You know?
Yep.
So I'm sure those choices would not have been made had that not been the case.
Yeah. Another thing I came across, and I don't know if you noticed this in the film, I definitely didn't, was that the house, the Park's house, the nice house on the hill, apparently only the bottom level, only the first floor actually exists in the external shots, and the second floor is sort of CG'd in place. Did you notice that at all?
No.
I thought that was wild. It made me want to watch it again. I haven't watched it in a few weeks, but
no, that is interesting.
Yeah. Anyway, so there's this definite up and down sort of thing. I'm sorry, you were talking about cinematography and how it sort of shows off this sort of vertical metaphor type of thing.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, I think we talked about it.
Okay, all right, cool. Well, I didn't know if you had other examples or other thoughts about it.
I didn't write down any other examples.
Sure.
But I mean, each time a character is introduced, each time a Kim family member comes into the house, like the mother when you first see her in the house, she's walking up the stairs with a something. And that happens over and over.
Yeah.
They're kind of elevating into this new plane of status, if that makes sense.
What do you think? Okay, so just to bring up this, because this is just a, you know, even if we weren't doing a podcast, a question I would ask you. So I rewatched it. I saw it in theaters the first time, and then I rewatched it here at the house with Chris. And Chris, my roommate, he didn't particularly think that the subplot of the Park family's son with his art, he didn't particularly think that paid off. What was your read on the Park's son? Was he just a sort of plot point to get the Kim family's sister into the house, or is there something else going on there?
No, I mean, it's the idea that, like, you know, this kid, like, if he's some kind of genius, he's not going to have to, like, work a trade to be successful. Like, I think that's the point.
Yeah.
It's to show like how much money this family will funnel into their son with art therapy. Like, you know, it's, you know, all the other characters are just barely scraping by and this kid's running around with a bow and arrow, like dressed as a Native American, like shooting people, and he's an artist. Like,
yep.
I think that's the
that was how I read it as well. Yeah,
I mean, there could have been a fun payoff with that. I don't know.
I've read in some places that where they'll draw a line between his interest in sort of Native American culture, and they'll wear, you know, headdresses and he has bows and arrows and whatever. I've read that some people have interpreted that as being sort of about colonialism or sort of oppression in a different way or something like that.
Sure.
I don't know how much of that was intentional, how much wasn't, but I do think that when you have those scenes where the sister, even though she's faking it, right, the sister who pretends to be the art therapist says something about, oh, this is the lower right quadrant of the artwork, and here's what that means, and et cetera, et cetera. I do think that just further highlights, like, if any of the Kim family's members were making any sort of art, nobody'd give a shit about what the lower right quadrant, what, you know what yeah. I'm saying? And so yeah. it's just sort of this thing where even more so it's like your expression, the things that you do to express yourself are taken more seriously by more people if you're wealthy, you know?
Yeah, so, totally. Absolutely.
Something like that. I asked before about like your sort of first thoughts, your initial thoughts after you watched it.
Yeah.
I watched it in the theaters the first time. And when I was leaving, like on my drive home, I remember thinking that was not very pleasant to watch. And I don't think I ever want to watch it again.
Yeah.
And
sure.
then like an hour later, I was, you know, I'd read 4 or 5 articles about it. And I was like, well, I'm going to have to watch it again.
Yeah. You know, oddly, like I actually oddly found a lot of it pleasant.
Really? Okay.
Just in that first act and a half. Like I said, I laughed a lot.
Yeah.
Not pleasant in the sense of what these people were experiencing, but like the craft and the humor, like yeah. I found that kind of pleasant.
Yeah.
So I didn't leave feeling like I don't want to watch that again. I definitely do want to watch it again.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
I remember, I just like, there were scenes in there, especially in the second and third act, where I was just tensed up. Like
sure.
it wasn't horror movie like that yeah. kind of tensed up, but it was definitely like, I am uncomfortable, this sucks.
Yeah.
you know,
I think for me, like yeah. when I first started watching it, like just the way everything's pieced together is like everything. Every movement of the camera kind of means something. It's
yeah.
like,
yeah.
it's a metaphor movie.
Yeah.
And in that sense, I'm not viewing it like a real thing happening.
Yeah. Yeah.
Does that make sense?
No, it does make sense. And I think it speaks really nicely to how you and I approach yeah. stuff differently.
No, absolutely.
Where you're very much looking at the craft of it, and I'm very much looking at the meaning of it. And
yeah.
so while, and this is one of the things I want to talk about as we dig in more, is, you know, this distinction between realism and metaphor. But, mm-hmm. You know, if you came away with sort of craft stuff, I came away with sort of meaning stuff in terms of socioeconomic disparity and stuff
yeah.
like that. And so I was very much tense because those elements are real, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Even though the Parks and the Kims are not real, it's this yeah. very, this sort of global capital, you know, income disparity and sort
right.
of, you know, a new poverty that's, you know, setting in with
yeah.
what used to be middle classes. And so I don't know. So, I mean, that does make
yeah.
total sense.
Yeah, and I will say, like, I didn't find it pleasant. Like,
no,
I think that's
sure.
that's the wrong way to put it.
No, no,
but
no.
like,
you found it aesthetically pleasant, right?
Aesthetically like, pleasant. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean that makes total sense, and that's the reason. After I read 4 or 5 articles, I was like, ah, damn it! Like, I have
yeah.
to watch this again.
Yeah.
Because it's there was no question in my mind when I left the theater. I was like, it's a masterpiece, but
yeah.
I don't know that I can fully articulate why, and beyond that, I'm deeply
yeah.
unpleasant right now. I feel
yeah.
deeply unpleasant right now. So,
okay, I have 1,000 other little
yeah
totally. Points to kind of talk about. I don't
yeah.
know where to start.
No, pick one. Yeah.
Okay, let's talk about water.
Okay.
Let's talk about the storm.
Let's do. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I would say one of the most uncomfortable moments for me was right before the storm, where the Kim family had to wait underneath a couch while
yes.
the Park husband and wife
yeah.
had sex.
Yeah, that was awful.
That was super uncomfortable,
yes.
super tense, super sad.
Yeah.
But immediately following that, so there's so much to unpack. So you have this family.
Yeah.
The Kim family,
mm-hmm.
they've basically decided at this point, and going into the second act or so, they're going to, while the Park family are away camping,
mm-hmm.
so they're camping with their son who's obsessed with the idea of Native American life, right,
yeah.
in some form or fashion, some way.
Yeah.
They're going to go hop in tents and, you know, sleep in the wilderness
yeah.
as a some form of luxury.
Yeah.
The Kim family decide, we're going to live in this mansion
yeah.
for a day or two and just really soak it up. Just yep. live, you know, they're drinking all of their booze.
Spend that time as if it's their house and their yeah. stuff.
Yeah. Absolutely. Immediately was tense for me because yes. I'm like, oh, they're coming home.
Oh my God. You yes. know what I mean? No, I feel completely the same way. When I was yeah. watching that scene, it was like,
oh, don't do that. God, don't yes. stop no. it.
They're overstepping their bounds in a yeah. way that like is not easy to get out of. And you can just right. feel it. I mean, this is part of why he's such a masterful filmmaker.
Yeah.
Is because he gives you no clues that they're going to really no. come. He doesn't signal it in any explicit way, but you know something is wrong.
But what's also kind of wonderful, right,
yeah.
is that I guess from a craft perspective is
yeah.
like you want to just automatically say, okay, the Parks are the bad guys, the
yes.
The Kims are the good guys, yep. but like in these kind of moments yeah. like he it's a choice to have this family kind of like getting drunk and like cursing at each other, and they're kind of yeah. rude and they're kind of like rough around the edges, but yeah. they're like a really tight and loving family. So like yeah. he's playing with the idea of the good guy and the bad guy.
Yes,
he's playing
he
with the idea of it. Yeah, he's playing. He's yeah. he's in a sandbox,
well,
and he's playing.
And that's right. kind of that's another point that's, you know, we might as well go ahead and get to right now, which is that as you said, the Kim family is never explicit it's never unquestionable that the Kim family is the good family and the Park family yeah. is bad. The Parks are not bad people,
no,
right?
Absolutely.
The Parks are not the antagonists of the film. It's not, you know, and
it's,
yeah.
I mean, if anything, if you're looking at motive and intention, like
yeah.
sure the Kims are trying to kind of give themselves a leg up, right? They're trying
yeah.
to climb up. They're helping each other. But the means in which they do that, they hurt
yeah.
other people
yeah.
who are essentially beneath them.
Yeah.
And the Kims see themselves in that sense, that they are now kind of above.
Yeah.
That they've climbed. So like their sense of that
yeah.
kind of status has their sense of their own status has elevated with them.
Well,
or with that.
And they reach too far too fast, right? I mean,
yeah.
they as soon as they get a taste of, you know, just what most people would like out of a life, like not even the sort of luxury of the Park family, but just to not live in a basement where you're taking free fumigation by getting,
yeah.
you know, insect repellent in the face.
Yeah.
Just a sort of regular, as soon as they get a taste of it, they immediately sort of move to this, like, what if this could be actually our life? We're going to take advantage of this while we can, this type of stuff. And
yeah, so and yeah. At this point in the movie, the original housekeeper
yeah
comes back
yeah,
and of course the Kim the mother in the Kim family
yeah
decides to answer that call because she's the new housekeeper
yeah,
and that's when she comes in and then she kind of scurries off and goes down into the basement and they're kind of waiting for mm-hmm. her. And so at this point, the original housekeeper's husband is now trapped in the basement of this paradise
yeah.
without any food.
Yeah.
Then the storm hits, right?
Yeah.
So, well, no, then they get a phone call that the Park family are coming
yeah,
home
the
early
storm,
and they'll
the
be there in like
the storm has hit before the woman gets there, but yeah.
And the storm, from a narrative position, the
yeah.
point, the purpose of that storm is to get the Park family home because you can't camp
yeah.
out in the rain.
Yeah.
So you have this water, this downpour. We've got now two different families in this house, and now you're just rooting for them to come together.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, we both know what this is like.
Mm-hmm.
Let's cover this up. Let's make sure everyone is taken care of.
Yeah.
And let's get out before they get back. But
sure.
no.
Yeah.
Of course not.
Yeah.
They start threatening each other.
Of course.
Yeah. It's, you know, the system is set up in a way that, you know, they're going to hurt each other
yeah.
to get higher.
And once again, the complicating feature here that I think is so smart and is so, honestly, and I've got some quotes that'll speak to this, you know, that we'll probably get to after the break, that part of what is so smart and also so kind of compassionate on the part of his writing is that, once again, the Parks are not villains. They're not,
no.
you know, they're not happy they're stepping on anybody. For the most part, they don't even realize it.
right?
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, you're absolutely right. The Kim family and then the family of the initial housekeeper, they start threatening each other, you know, once the housekeeper realizes that the Kim family is lying and taking advantage, she takes a video of them and starts threatening to send it to the Park family, et cetera. In terms of water and in terms of that rain, I mean, you said that one of the narrative purposes is to get the Park family back to their house to create that tension. Yeah. But the other purpose, right, is to flood the Kim family's home.
It's this idea of washing the sewage back down the hill, right?
Yeah.
It's this idea that, like, these people are kind of part of the sewage.
That's one take,
and I'll get into that later.
Yeah.
And then, so, you know, the storm that happens is inevitable. The storm's always going to hit, but your status will dictate the amount of damage that's caused by that. So you have this family who's trying to get, you know, this wealthy family who's now home. The son's out in a tent in the yard and he's getting rained on, and the husband and wife are having fun on the couch, and this other family is hiding only to get out to safety, to be washed down the hill in the storm into their house, which is now completely flooded.
Yeah.
And the only refuge they have is to sit on top of a toilet that's spewing sewage.
Yeah.
Which, but then when you see that image, did you not, it's funny, right? It's not, but it is. But that's why he's so genius. Like, he can get like a laugh out of her, like sitting on top of a toilet and just this brown poo water shooting out, you know, like, the guy's a master.
Yeah, he is.
But so this idea of like flushing the lesser away, right, is actually foreshadowed.
Yeah.
So, and it's kind of this idea, this series of threes, where when the movie kind of starts and they're peering out into the street, the light, and oh, like, look, there's hope. We're in purgatory. This isn't great, but look, there's always hope.
Yeah.
And then a drunk kind of stumbles up in front of their window and starts peeing, and then they're saved by this beacon of light that kind of rides into frame, and it's the son's friend who offers the job. That's the inciting incident.
Yeah.
And he yells at him and makes him leave, right?
Yeah.
So the next time they're kind of, the Kims are home, and this guy is out peeing in front of their window. Mm-hmm. Now they have this inflated sense of power.
Yep.
So they go out and they just cover him with water, buckets of water. They're spraying him with water. So this guy, this drunk, who is obviously now beneath them, they feel comfortable flushing him away.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the third time is this larger scope of now that's, they're obviously the, they're not there's so many different ways to read this, and that's why it's so great. And my take on this entire movie is the opposite of what it looks like on the surface, and I'm sure you're going to have a similar take.
Interesting.
But, you know, they get kind of flushed down, back into their own purgatory, and then their purgatory, that bottom part is now filled with water, but like that top, you know, the top is still clear. It's still, there's air up. So they're still in between, but they're drowning.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah. I mean,
he may not have intended that at all, but
yeah, but I think it's a fantastic take. And to some extent, I mean, what you're saying is true, which is the fact that this narrative and the way that he presents it bears so many reasonable interpretations. The fact that you can talk about that and about the role of sewage, and, you know, I hear that and I go, man, that's plausible. And I didn't even think about it. Right. The fact that you can do that in so many directions is why this film is so rich, is why it won so many awards, and why it's so good, you know? Yeah. I mean, on just a more, and this is nothing, you know, new that really wasn't implied in what you said, but just on more of a surface level reading, it also just shows the fact that what is just a nice, you know, background noise, sort of white noise rainstorm for the wealthy family is life and death for the poor family, right?
You see that he shows you A and B the next morning in such a beautiful way, right? So you know that they're being flooded, the wealthy family is enjoying their kind of staycation camping trip up on the top of the hill. Mm-hmm. The next morning, the wife wakes up, she walks into her like walk-in closet trying to pick clothes, and then it cuts to this giant pile of clothes in this refuge of all these poor people, like trying to find the right size.
Yeah.
You know, it cuts into their car. They're actually, you know, the wealthy family is now like planning this party for their son.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she even says something on the phone to a friend or something, man, that, you know, that rain was really a blessing because today's sky is really blue and there's no pollution for the party.
Yeah.
They're going to have a garden party. And then in order for this party to happen, what has to happen? The Kim family has to go back to work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So you see them on the floor of like these gymnasiums, just like, you know, soaking wet. And they're like, okay, well, in order for this party to happen for this little boy, we've got to, we got to, you know, pull up our bootstraps and go back to work.
And the mother of the Park family sort of plays it off as if like, and she genuinely thinks this, right? She's not a villain once again, but she plays it off when she calls the various, you know, members of the Kim family to let them know they need to work. She plays it off as if it's going to be fun, right? She's like, oh, come and eat whatever and blah, blah, blah. You can dress casual, like whatever. And it just sort of shows.
And they don't have any clothes to wear.
Yeah, exactly.
They're digging through a pile of clothes to find the.
And so they're, you know, who is the antagonist in this movie? Who are the antagonists? There really aren't any, right?
Yeah, I think the antagonist is just the structure of the way things work.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's a tragedy of circumstances where this is how everything works, this is how resources are distributed, and therefore everything is broken.
I think after the storm and when this party kind of starts, and then, you know, his family is dying because this kind of deranged man. Oh, by the way, they killed the housekeeper. Killed the housekeeper accidentally, but they did. She fell down the stairs and she died.
Wait, no, she didn't die. Doesn't she speak later to her husband or not? Doesn't she say something about how dizzy she is when she's laying at the bottom of the steps? Maybe my chronology is wrong on
this. I think she did, but I thought she died after
She may have died after that. I don't remember. But I don't think the initial
and I think
thud
that's
killed
what,
her.
Right, no. And I think that's the thing that causes her husband to go ballistic at this party.
That's right.
So then the party happens, the husband gets out. He knocks the son out. You think he kills him with, I don't remember, some blunt object, right?
Yeah. Well, oh, it's the, is it not the,
is it
the
stone?
Scholar stone? Yeah.
Man, that's so good. It's so good. He gets out. He kills the daughter. The daughter's bleeding to death. She dies. And it's at that moment when Mr. Kim is asked, he's like, what are you doing? Like, my family's is in trouble. You have to drive us to safety.
Yes.
He snaps, loses it, like this is you know, ridiculously unfair, and he kills the Park
and
husband.
The sort of visceral moment, the sort of straw that broke the camel's back in this case, is the fact that the father, Mr. Park, whenever he goes to pick up the keys for the car, right, and the basement man is now sort of wounded and so forth, he goes to pick up the car, and he thinks that Mr. Kim needs to drive him to safety. He picks it up, and he holds his nose. He holds his nose because of the smell. Do you remember this?
Yes.
And that is the sort of catalyst moment, because it refers back to this line that he says earlier, where he says that Mr. Kim has this smell, and he talks about
he's
it.
He's a great driver, but, you know, he has this smell.
Yeah, he's a good driver. He never crosses the line, but he has this smell. He says it's like an old radish, or it's like when you, it's a basement smell. It's like when you boil a rag, you know, something like that. And so when Mr. K, and once again, can't emphasize enough, Mr. Park is not a terrible person. He's not a villain, but he's just desensitized to the world that people around him are living in. And so when he goes to pick up his keys, he pinches his nose, and that sends Mr.
Bong's,
Kim over the edge.
You know, Bong's choice in Mr. Park's job is no coincidence either.
Yeah.
He works in VR.
Oh,
he works in virtual reality. So like, you know, this idea, like it's just this idea of this fantasy world in front of him. Like, it's not real.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is pretty interesting.
Yeah, that is. Do you want to take a quick break and then come back and talk a little bit more about the meaning of this film and what we're taking away from it, and et cetera?
Sure. Yeah, let's do it.
Dope. All right. Well, check this thing out, and then we'll be back to finish up our talk about Parasite.
There's a thing to check out.
Hi, my name is Stephen Long, and I host a show here on Rock Candy called Sacred Tension. It's about the spiritual discipline of asking questions. If you find yourself uncomfortable in your faith, or if you find yourself caught between modern science and ancient religion, or if you're curious about the journeys of others who are sorting out faith and doubt, Sacred Tension is a place where nothing is off limits. You will find conversations with pastors, cult experts, spiritual leaders, and skeptics, all discussing the ways we navigate the faiths we were given. Find Sacred Tension right here on Rock Candy and wherever you listen to podcasts.
And we back.
And we back.
And we back. And we back. I still haven't made you that Chance the Rapper
playlist.
Right.
Yeah, we're keep threatening.
On Spotify.
Keep threatening that episode. It's going to happen at some point. All right, so y'all checked out that little ad spot that we did right there. Check out that podcast. It's real good. It's real good. So Parasite, let's jump back in there. We mentioned in the break, we mentioned to each other, we've both been just jumping around in our notes, which is true.
Just super prepared.
Yeah, super prepared. Well, I do. I have a lot of notes, so I feel prepared. It's just that I don't have a sort of solid through line, so I'm just kind of all over the place.
I was hoping you did so that I could just spout out whatever I thought as you spoke. But
well, I do. Okay, so I
kind of worked that way.
Yeah, kind of worked that way. I do have something that I want to talk about for this post-break element of the discussion, which is I want to talk about sort of what type of movie this is and why that's interesting. So we mentioned it a little bit before, but I think the shift in tone and the role of genre is really one of the most interesting things about this movie. So the meaning, the sort of socioeconomic commentary, that stuff's all fascinating, and I'm sure I'll have more to say about that before we're done here, but like the notion of like what type of movie is this? Not just in terms of where would you put it in Blockbuster, but like, is this an art house film? Is it a sort of blockbuster film? Is it, you know, a drama? Is it a genre movie? That type of thing. Do you know what I mean? I feel like part of what's super fascinating about this movie is that it kind of breaks down all those dichotomies. Like, there just sort of is no answer to those questions. It moves, it moves back and forth. And I think that's part of why it's so good.
Yeah. I would say your typical blockbuster, a lot of those stories are trying to kind of teach you a lesson, trying to show you how to change the world, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
This movie doesn't do that.
Yes.
At all. It doesn't give you any answers. It just shows you what it is.
Yeah.
And I have a quote from the director, which is pretty dope.
Yeah, please.
He said, "There are people who are fighting hard to change society. Yeah. I like those people, and I'm always rooting for them. But making the audience feel something naked and raw is one of the greatest powers of cinema.
Yeah.
I'm not making a documentary or propaganda. Mm. It's not about telling you how to change the world or how you should act because something is bad, but rather showing you the terrible, explosive weight of reality.
Ooh.
That's what I believe is the beauty of cinema."
He pulled that off. Like, there's no question he was successful in doing that. I mean, one of the things I have in my notes is the fact that this film is not preachy at all.
No.
It's not preachy, but because of that, I feel like it is very pessimistic in some ways.
Sure.
It doesn't, or at least my reaction to it was as if it's very pessimistic. It might just be descriptive, but there is no solution articulated by the movie. It does not tell you how to fix this. It doesn't give you, and let's talk about the last scene a little bit, because this is what I keep thinking of when I'm thinking about this, right? The last scene is the son survives getting hit by that big rock. The mother survives. The two other members, the daughter dies of the of the Kim family, and then the dad goes into hiding in the basement. So the dad has now moved down.
The Park family moves away. Another wealthy family moves in. Yes. He's completely trapped underneath. Yeah.
And he's wanted for murder. I mean, that's why
he's wanted for murder. Yeah, that's why he does it.
That's why he can't leave. And so the son, it ends with the son sort of writing this letter to his dad. The dad
the son on a hike sees, and there's this whole thing with Morse code, right?
Yeah.
Throughout the movie, where the father uses Morse code on a with a light switch on the outside of the house from the basement to send to let his family know where he is, and the son sees that, and then he's writing a letter from here.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. So he's writing a letter to his father that he presumes his father will not ever read, I think, right? I don't think he has a plan for how to get this letter to his father.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, he's writing this, and in writing this, he talks about how he's going to earn a lot of money. He's eventually going to buy the home. And then once that happens, all his dad will have to do is just walk up from the basement.
Just walk up the stairs.
Just walk up the stairs.
And something as simple as just walking up the stairs.
Exactly. Yeah. And when he is writing this and narrating it, when you hear his voice talking about, I'm going to make a lot of money, I'm going to buy, you see scenes of the son doing those things. His hair has changed. He looks older. He's wearing like nice clothing. He you know, is at the home, at the home that was the Parks home, with a real estate agent, presumably, and they're looking around. And then you see the scene of the mother in the yard, the son in the yard, and then the dad just walks up the stairs as he's saying this.
And he could have chosen to end the movie right there.
He certainly could have.
But he did not.
He did not choose that. Yeah.
Instead, he cuts back to where the movie started.
Yeah.
Which is in the basement, right?
The half basement.
The basement, the half level house.
Yeah. And he cuts back to the son who is writing the letter, right?
Yeah.
And so what he lets you know is this is just what the son is thinking.
This is the son's fantasy.
This is the son's fantasy.
And he's been quoted in saying, like, listen, this is never going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
This idea of how to get his father out of the house will never happen.
Yeah.
And that is very pessimistic.
Yeah.
But even though the director doesn't say this, I have a slightly different reading of it a little bit.
Sure.
Everything we've seen so far is that he starts the son doesn't end the movie in the basement. The son ends the movie where he started.
Sure.
In a position where there's hope, right?
Okay.
So he's still looking out. He's not further down. The father is. The son tricked a lot of people to get him where they got, right?
Yeah.
So the son, like, his, you know, his, unfortunately, his you know, it's kind of like a bittersweet kind of thing where the son could get the dad out of the house.
Yeah.
The son is smart and a cunning kid who could figure it out. It's just not going to be the way that he is writing in this letter.
Interesting. Okay.
And I mean, the whole movie shows us that. The whole movie, like, the whole idea of this movie is the fact that you have this family who, this ensemble family who is gifted, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the way the structure of the society works, regardless of how gifted you are, you're never going to be the Park family.
Yeah. No.
You can be, you can utilize what you have to bend and flex things to make your way up.
Sure.
You don't have to be in that basement, right?
See, that's such an interesting, that is not how I read that ending at all,
right?
Which is so interesting.
And I don't know that that's, you know, my reading of it, like all of the things that happen in the movie, like the kid's still optimistic at the end.
It's true.
It doesn't mean that he's just going to give up on his father. Like,
that's true.
If that were the case, they would have ended the movie differently, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, that is a great point, and it's something I had never thought about, right? I mean, I think I thought about it in terms of, like, and actually I found a quote where Bong Joon-ho said something to the effect of, the last shot is what he called a kill shot.
Like, yeah, I saw that too.
Yeah, and so that's how I read it even before I had come across that quote, which is like, this is not going to happen, because the part of the fantasy that he sort of breezes over and doesn't discuss is he just says, I'm going to make a lot of money. Oh, really? How?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Oh, how are you going to make a lot of money? You have no opportunities, you know, this kind of thing. And so, but I like that reading.
I read it as a kill shot of his fantasy.
Sure.
He will never be the Parks family.
Yeah.
He will never be a wealthy person.
Yeah.
But he's proven what he's capable of, right?
That's interesting.
The whole family has proven that they can take what they're given and make it work.
Well, see, And so what I think is so very interesting about the fact that you have that read on it. And I mean,
I think that's why I didn't have this.
Yeah.
Gut. I mean, and you know, that's what I think, that's what sucks about, you know, the reality of it is that's how you have to be to do anything.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, unless you're just born into it.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Unless you're just born into wealth.
Yeah. There is no, I mean, another movie that sort of this brings to mind in the moment is Nightcrawler with Jake Gyllenhaal. Right. I don't know if you ever saw that.
But I did.
Yeah, it's a powerful movie too. But it's sort of this notion that, look, you're not able to, there's no sort of, the belief is that there's this sort of class mobility in the U.S. And I know this is about South right. Korea, but the
American dream.
Exactly. I mean, this is the sort of capitalist dream, right? Wherever it shows up. And so the fact that South Korea is dealing with increased income inequality and so is the U.S. is part of why I think this film did so well here, because these themes are very like, yeah, we get it. Like,
absolutely.
You know, especially younger people understand, like, there is no social security, like, not social security, but, you know, there is no security in the social system. There are low paying jobs with no security, et cetera, et cetera. And so, I don't know. I think the fact that it bears your interpretation to some extent shows how much you think about narratives in terms of character. Because I definitely thought of, I mean, the way that you explain that ending is very much about the journey of that particular character, right?
Right.
He comes out of it optimistic, and you're absolutely right. Whereas I was reading this film primarily in terms of theme.
Macro.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The sort of macro thing where it's like, it don't matter what he thinks. He's optimistic. Cool. It's going to crush him. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think that's, I think it's another proof that this is a masterpiece, that it can bear both those interpretations depending on what you're focusing on. So let me ask this question then. Is this a realistic movie or not?
I mean, in terms of like the types of people in the society, it's very realistic.
Yeah.
In terms of the specific kind of plots of this movie, it's very kind of stylized and almost surreal. Like it's a heist movie, it's a horror movie, it's a thriller movie, and the things that these people specifically go through and the way they interact isn't very realistic. But the kind of fish angle lens on it is like, oh no, this reads as real life.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it totally does. I think part of, you know, and it shows up the fact that everything is so symbolic but also plays so realistically, I think is part of what's, you know, just the fact that he is a master of making something that is coherent but doesn't really match sort of genre, doesn't really match sort of type of narrative that we're used to. It's, you know, it's so metaphorical. quote the film, it's so metaphorical. But at the same time, it also plays realistically. I have a quote from the New York Times that I'll pull out here to kind of talk about this. It says,
"Fire it off, bruh."
It says, "Bong likes to choreograph wildly improbable chases and fights, but he doesn't cheat at physics. A reason for the frequent comparisons to Hitchcock and Spielberg is the ruthless precision of his technique, but for all his love of whimsy and absurdity, he doesn't play games with human psychology. To call Bong a realist, though, would be crazy." And then it goes on to say, "At the same time, his movies are dark and subtle, burrowing deep into sticky ethical problems and hot zones of social dysfunction. You could say he uses blockbuster means to advance art house ends. You could also say the opposite. His real achievement, though, is to scramble such facile distinctions and a host of others as well." And so I think I just, when I read that, I was like, yeah, that's it. It just is sort of a singular thing on its own. You can't really, it draws from all these sorts of things, but it draws from so many disparate things, and it's saying so many things in so many different ways that it would really have been a crime not to give this thing Best Picture, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It does everything a movie can do for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
I mean, it does it
better than all the other movies.
I mean, that's kind of wild to say, but it is true. Like, it has social meaning. It has big themes. It has characters that are worthwhile. The craft of it is good. Genre, it's everything from funny to terrifying to brutal. Mm-hmm. It's sort of all the things. The more I think about it, the more I'm just incredibly impressed with the movie.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Which is, once again, not saying anything new, but...
Yeah. You know. Here's a question.
Yeah.
Who is the parasite in the movie?
Yeah. Very good. Why is it called that?
And I struggled with this for a while until I read the definition of parasite.
Oh, interesting. What?
So originally, okay, you've got this family who's basically like moving their way into this house, and each member of the Kim family finds a host.
Sure.
Just like a parasite,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
To feed off of, financially feed off of their kind of equal.
Yeah.
Person in this house, right?
Yeah.
So this idea that this family is the parasite that's going into this house,
sure.
And I'm like,
yeah,
I don't that doesn't sit right with me. That rubs me the wrong way.
Yeah.
Just in general, like this family's doing what it has to do to survive.
Yeah.
Let's not call this family a parasite.
Exactly.
But then I read the definition. The definition of a parasite is an organism that lives in or on an organism of
yeah.
another species, its
yeah.
host. And benefits by deriving nutrients at the other's expense. And then it made me think, okay, who's experiencing the expense,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And that's this underbelly, lower class, the bottom of the barrel,
yeah.
to where you, and the thing that kind of pushed home the fact that I think he's kind of saying they're both parasitic in
yeah.
their own ways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I think he's saying that the wealthy are parasites,
yes.
on the lower class,
yep.
and the reason he says that there, he specifically put a scene in there where the park father is talking to his driver, his new driver, the Kim, and he's basically saying that without the help in the house,
yeah.
they wouldn't survive.
Yep.
He
yep.
says my clothes would start to smell.
Yep.
If I didn't have a housekeeper, my wife has no talent for housework. She's bad at cleaning, and her mm-hmm. cooking is awful. You know,
yeah.
his son would probably whatever. And then it's yeah. like this whole idea that like sure like
yes
on the surface the parasites are this family
yes.
that's coming in, but from a macro view,
yes.
you've got the wealthy that's parasitic, and their host is
yeah.
the rest of society.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, all you have to do to sort of, and I think you're right, it cuts both ways, you know, in this particular
yeah.
instance, yes, on the
moment
obvious.
Moment to moment.
Moment,
right?
Yeah. On this particular instance, in sort of narrative plot terms, yes, the poor family becomes parasitic on the wealthy family. But when you think about it in terms of looking at which of these families is self-sufficient, right?
Yeah.
And which requires the labor and the resources of the other. Well, the wealthy mm-hmm. family is the parasite, right? I mean, they're
yeah.
sort of...
Who derives the nutrients at the other's expense
exactly,
more?
Exactly, exactly. The wealthy family is a sort of tick getting fat on the blood of the poor family. And
yeah.
This is part of why this movie is such a... just a brilliant critique of unfettered capitalism, because
yeah.
it's not, you know, there's this sort of idealized version of capitalism where, oh, I have too many shoes and you have too much rice. Let's barter and sell with one another, you know, both voluntarily and sort of on equal footing. And it's like,
yeah.
this is not what you see in places that let markets, you know, just completely have domination over the social structure. You see parasitic relationships where we don't have equal amounts of things and we have to use and dehumanize one another just to survive. And so it's sort of one of those things where, you know, this is why he's so brilliant not making the Park family bad, really, right? I mean,
yeah.
they do things that are distasteful, but it's always because mm-hmm. they're ignorant. He doesn't know.
Yeah.
If he knew how offensive and terrible that was to talk about his driver smelling like a basement, he probably wouldn't do that. He's not a bad guy, you know?
Right.
It's just that he's ignorant. He lives in a different world than
in VR, would you say? In a virtual reality
exactly,
oasis?
Exactly, dude. Yes, nicely done. Yeah.
Oh, man.
Oh, man. There's so much good,
yeah.
rich meaning in this movie.
Yeah. And then you have the Kim family who are intentionally hurting people
yeah.
to climb up because they have to.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Because what's the alternative?
right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. You can be. And so to some extent, this film is a really interesting critique of our sort of standard approach to morality. And I haven't done very much thinking about this, so I won't just talk off the cuff. But it's sort of the notion of like, is it really morally wrong for them to do this when they're in a situation where everything is just against them? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
To be fair, for them to try to be fair and be honest and stuff like that, those things are not going to pay off for them.
Right.
They're put in a situation where being honest and upfront and sort of what we would think of as moral is just going to hurt them. It's not going to be good.
Yeah. You know, and I would argue that that's what he's trying to say, even if not specifically, like even with the ending, the kid,
yeah,
you know, it doesn't just mean he's not going to get his father back. It means that he's going to have to do some stuff to do it. He's not going to do it the way of the system.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
But
yeah,
he's still hopeful that he could do it that way. But the reality is he's going to have to probably like put someone else on the street to get his father back.
Yeah.
You know,
or absolutely.
To get to that position.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is what, I mean, this is why it's such a frustrating film too. I mean, it's so good, but it's so frustrating, which is like, just tell me how it can be better at all. And this movie and Bong Joon-ho in general has no interest in doing that, right?
Yeah.
I got one more quote from this really good New York Times article talking about these types of things. It says, the pleasure and discomfort can't be separated. We're watching players compete in a rigged game with potentially mortal stakes and unreliable referees. Institutions, schools, companies, and governments are comically and also lethally useless. There is no legitimate authority, only raw power. Family connections are the only bonds that count, but families are a mess. The only answer is a kind of wily resourcefulness and an on-the-fly problem-solving knack that can deliver, at best, small local victories. I just thought that's so good. Like, things just are not fair. Like, they're just not full stop. I don't know. It sort of reminds me of the theme that we've come to a couple of times in previous episodes, which is this notion of like giving the impression that everything is or can be okay is probably not going to make the best art. You know, the art that is most powerful is the one that's going to leave you with the problem or leave you with the question.
Right.
And he does it in a way that's not, it's not oppressive. It's not oppressively terrible. I mean, you said you enjoyed the film. Like, this is why it's better than just straight pessimism. It's complicated. Yeah.
And to all the people who are saying, well, I'm not going to watch it if they're not going to overdub it for me. I want to watch a movie, not read a movie.
Yeah.
To quote Hulu, the snarky little Hulu that I love now, you know, you don't have to read the movie. You can always learn Korean.
That's very good.
You can listen to it how they intended. I will say, though, that with these types of movies, like, I need a multiple viewings just because, like, I study the frame when I'm watching a movie. Like, I don't just look where, like, you know, because, like, the way shots are composed, like, they've done studies where they can track eye movement.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can kind of, the composition of a shot can kind of direct your eye in one spot.
Yeah.
And I watch a movie in a sense where I start there, but then I wander.
Yeah.
Because I just like to take it all in.
Yeah.
And with a subtitle movie, you can't really do that.
No, it's true. You got to,
because you'll miss something.
You got to hit the beats and then get the words. And, yeah.
So, exactly. You know, the second time I watched Let the Right One In was more aesthetically pleasing for me versus the first time.
Yeah.
The first time it's just like, what happens? The second time is, I'm going to just kind of enjoy the craft.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's almost one of those things where it's like, it's almost like reading a comic book that doesn't wait on you. You know what I mean? Like, you have to do both, but you can't really steep in it because it's going to move along. But wonderful film. You got anything else you want to throw in before we rate Parasite?
Probably, but I think we've given them enough.
Yeah, sounds good. I think we dug into the most prominent points. Yeah. So dope. Well, you wanna rate it first?
Yeah, I'll rate it first.
Go for it.
I think the pessimism of this movie will knock off 1 point.
Sure.
And I would, just because it's a masterpiece, just take it all the way up to the top, but like that's not as fun to just rate everything perfect scores, right?
No, of course, yeah.
So I'm gonna give it 9 out of 10.
Okay.
Fecal faucets.
Okay. Fecal faucets. That's very good. Yeah, 9 out of 10. That's a strong showing. I'm also not going to give it a perfect 10 because, you know, I'm not only rating how good I think this objectively is, whatever that means with art. I'm not only rating that. I'm giving, like, my personal rating. And so, you know, it is, in terms of rewatchability, I'm not going to, like, revisit this movie all the time. It's a taxing watch, for sure.
Yeah.
And it was one of those things where it's kind of a weird thing. So when I think about how taxing it was the first time I watched it, that makes me want to pull it down to about an 8. But mm-hmm. I think in the wake of understanding the rarity of a piece of art that can make me feel that tense and that uncomfortable and stuff like that, I think that's going to push it back up. So I think I'm going to land at a 9.5. So not perfect.
Ooh, a little 9.5 action.
Yeah. I'm going to give it 9.5 out of 10 old radish smells. So 9.5 out of 10 old radish smells. So we got 9 and 9.5 out of 10 respectively.
Yeah.
So that's a good showing. I mean, that's a damn good showing from Parasite. At some point, I'm sure we'll do like a full Bong Joon-ho thing where we talk a little bit about Parasite, but like dig into his other stuff. I could.
Yeah, he's got lots of good stuff.
So this is Common Creatives Podcast. Thanks for listening, everybody. This is a dual production of Rock Candy Recordings, Rock Candy Media out of Asheville, North Carolina, and also the Destination Nation Network out of here in Louisville, Kentucky. Reach out to us. Let us know what you want us to talk about. We'll do episodes on pretty much whatever. Instagram is Common Creatives Podcast, and our email is commoncreativespodcast@gmail.com.
I had a random thought.
Yeah, throw it out there.
All right, the kid, the native, his obsession with the Native Americans, yep. Like that could totally represent a larger, a man-made wealthier creature being a parasite on something else, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Coming in and just completely... Yes.
Yeah, no, that's true. I had heard it said in terms of like it references sort of colonialism and stuff like that. And I was like, yeah, that makes sense. But when you put it, I mean, and this is the same thing, but when you put colonialism in terms of being a parasitic force, I think it drives it even more. That's super good. All right, 9.5 and 9 out of 10. That's what's up with Parasite. So in terms of being a genre blending black comedy, drama, thriller, horror movie that critiques capitalism and also references, udon noodles, would you say that you concur, Doctor?
Divide and concur is what I say.
That's so metaphorical.
Yep.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Like a walking metaphor. Okay.
Thank you for listening, DNN.
To find out more, visit rockcandyrecordings.com.